This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. For this bonus interview, I'm joined by Dave Chawner. He's a number one best-selling author of Weight Expectations, One Man's Recovery from Anorexia, a comic and presenter. He was previously on the show talking all about recovery, which we recorded whilst he was up at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Like the cancellation of that, much of his career is currently on hold with comedy. So in the interview, we talk about how he's finding that as something that's usually a big part of how he processes his emotions and a lot of what he's been through in his life in a way that feels productive and safe for him. At the same time as being away from that usual outlet of his, he's also lost a close family member to COVID-19. And we talk about the difficulties of grieving, especially during this time. I found it to be a really frank conversation, and you can tell, even I think listening back to it, how much he's still figuring out, as we all are, as we adapt to what our lives are now and how our lives will be different even post-lockdown. So I'm really grateful for him coming on to speak to me again, and I'd really recommend, if you enjoy this episode, checking out his previous one with us that I'll link in the description as well. So with all that said, we'll get into this interview with Dave Chawner in a moment, but first... Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So my name is Dave, and my lockdown experience, like everyone's, I suppose, has been surreal and odd. I think mine was made a little bit more unusual by the fact that kind of early into the whole experience, my dad became unwell and incredibly quickly, unfortunately, passed away. And I think I've been trying to sort of make sense of that, as it was something that was so quick and so unexpected, while at the same time everything else being so surreal, and it feels like some kind of like banal apocalyptic movie. Like, it's not even been dramatic, you know what I mean? Like, if this was some sort of Steven Spielberg, Bruce Willis kind of film, there would be the aliens are coming, but it's been incredibly mundane. I don't know if you found that.
In the very early stages, I think I got caught up with how it was being framed as like a war effort. And so I was like frantically looking for things I could do, thinking I've got to do something. When years on from this, I'm talking to grandchildren, I want to be able to say that I've done something. And of course, you know, we did settle into it being a new normal quickly enough. But certainly that initial period, I was like, no, I need to be taking action. I need to go out there and rescue people.
I think that's the truth of like life, though, isn't it? That like, as I say, if this was a Hollywood script, there would be, you know, there would be mass looting of shops. There would be people getting in cars and driving through the night. But the reality of the situation is people just sitting at home going, oh, God, I'm going to tell my grandkids about this. And what am I going to tell them? I just absolutely binged watched episodes of The Tiger King. That's my take home from this. I've caught up with Netflix, and I've found that I can still be in my pajamas at 3 p.m. You know, it's a very odd take home message. It's a very surreal experience.
Do you feel like you've been able to process that with what's going on and not being able to grieve as normal?
I don't know. I definitely like haven't grieved, and I people have like said things like, oh, it's going to be a big Edinburgh show next year and all of those things. But I kind of want to shy away from that sort of thing. And I actually think that there are little pockets of life that aren't always squeaky clean and aren't always stuff that fits into a nice narrative. And I think this has definitely been one of them. I was so lucky that I was incredibly close to my dad, and I loved him, and he was emotionally intelligent. He was kind. He was a brilliant man. And it's odd with things like Father's Day coming up that like normally I'd like just drive up to him, but that's not even a reality anymore. So I don't almost feel like I've sort of
missed out on him because it's not something that I can do. I can't see him on his birthday. I can't see him on Father's Day or, you know, at Easter. But that's not because he's dead. That's because I wouldn't have been able to anyway. So I think there's going to be a huge wake-up period as we come out of lockdown of people actually almost grieving a second time because they're like, oh God, that person is actually gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as you say, you wouldn't be seeing him like normal anyway. So it may not have really sunk in that regard. And then when much of your life starts to get back to normal and that never does, that could be the real shock of it.
And I find it quite difficult as well, especially I always kind of shirk at the sort of title comedian purely because that's like that's an all-encompassing thing. That's an identity descriptor rather than a job descriptor. But especially with something like there's literally no light to be had about Dad's passing. And kind of I'm very aware that now when I talk about it, people are like, Jesus, I thought it was meant to be funny. You know what I mean? And it's like this isn't funny at all, and that's been quite hard to sort of make sense of that. And I think comedy has always been a way for me to sort of try and make sense of stuff. And actually, like, Dad's like passing away wasn't funny in any real way. It's not like, you know, he died trying to swim in a vat of mayonnaise. It's actually something that's very banal that affected a lot of people. So It's been really odd. That's been a real mind screw.
Yeah, for sure. And for context, if the listeners aren't familiar with your comedy, they may not know how much you do mine your personal experience. And particularly from my perspective, you really appropriately bring mental health themes into your work as well, which I think is great. But you're right, it's so much more difficult in this situation. But also, I think not by coincidence, you're used to it being you-centric. That it's a lot easier to make fun of yourself and you have ownership over that. But even in a different circumstance, it's so much more difficult to make comedy around family.
Yes, I completely agree with that because it's not only just me that it affects, but also it's really difficult to tell when like a bad day is a bad mental health day. And actually, grief is like such a big thing that there was a period where I was really wobbly and I was kind of, is that like all right? Is that like a slippery slope down to where I've been before? Is that very natural? And I find the kind of like, at least the early start of the grieving process of kind of like, it's hard to tell, like, is this something bigger or is this just a very natural response to something that's really sad? So that has been really, really odd. And I'm also like, you know, I want to keep his memory alive. But again, something that is quite funny is not in an inauthentic way, not in a trying to like beatify him and pretend he was a saint. So his last ever Facebook post was, I used to do this weekly silly fun pub quiz and he tried to watch it, but instead of actually clicking on to watch it, he accidentally recorded himself going, Dave, I can't get this fucking thing to work. Fucking. And it's just him swearing time after time. And you go on his Facebook page and that's the last thing that he posts. You go, I can't find this fucking thing working. And I just think that's so funny. And it's everything about it has been like this really, really big mind screw. Like even in his funeral, my mom said that because Dad was so into Superman, he loved Superman. So they said when the coffin went into the funeral, it would be quite a nice thing to have the Superman theme tune played, which is a nice idea. But the problem was the cemetery, the crematorium had got the Superman theme tune from the film. So it was the soundtrack that went on for an hour and a half. And so the first, you only get 20 minutes at a crematorium. So the first 10 minutes is just standing there listening to this film score with everyone like looking out the corner of their eyes to each other and going like,
when is this going to stop? Like, is this just it now? Is this just how we live? It's so odd. So there have been, like, odd sort of moments. But I think everyone's got those little stories of how surreal this kind of lockdown experience is and the things that have come out of it. Like, clap for the NHS. I never thought that would be a thing. I never thought that we would actually treat people stacking shelves with respect and reverence rather than actually being quite snooting. I know you're only stacking shelves. It's been such a subversion of everything. I think there's going to be a huge sort of mental health question mark over this period.
So many really good points there. I do think it's really interesting how you've talked about the kind of appropriateness of how you're feeling. It is something that sort of baffles me as it comes to mental health. This constant judgment of, are my feelings appropriate? And in many ways, grief is like the pinnacle of that. That there can even be this hierarchy where you're at the church, perhaps, or at the crematorium, and there's this kind of comparison that can happen in the wings of who's more upset than who, and is that person more upset than they should be given how well they knew the person? And this really strange kind of quantifying and rationing of sadness.
I think it's a really good point. And someone pointed out certain people have taken it better than others in the family. But one of my friends pointed out to me that grief by its nature is necessarily selfish. That's not to say it's a bad thing, but like, my dad isn't grieving. Unfortunately, my dad is gone. It's actually what I'm grieving for is that I won't be able to see him again. So it's a very me-centric thing.
I actually think that's a really good way of looking at it, because that explains why it's so internal and so uncomparable, because your relationship with him is unique. Not just because he's your dad, you're two individual people. And so every relationship is unique.
It is. And I think it's also really easy to change that relationship in death, which I instantly realise sounds like a ridiculous thing, because of course it's changed. But one of my mates said to me the other day about that they're a more mature mate, and they sort of said when their dad died, I still speak to him. And I went on a walk the other day and I'd sort of tried to think what I would say to my dad if he was there, and like the truth of the matter is he'd probably be complaining about the traffic on the A3. You know, me and dad never had this sort of grandiose philosophical walking about talking about existential problems. It would normally be like, oh Christ, well I couldn't get a sandwich because the services were closed and the box were blocked. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I don't want to gild that lily too much and completely change that relationship that we have and forget the kind of real down to earthness of everything that we sort of have had. So it's a really odd time. I still kind of feel like the jury's out as to how I have dealt with that grief. And I think that's going to be the same for so many other people. Is it at the moment 54,000 deaths? And if you think that, you know, each death has a ripple effect, yeah, I want to be upbeat, but I think we're going to be screwed after this.
Yeah, there'll be a hell of a lot of grieving to do, and it's going to be a long process.
Yeah,
because in so many ways your grieving is on pause, and it's the type of grief that often does take a very long time anyway when it's a parent, because so much of your existence, the fact that you even exist, is because of them.
Yeah.
You know, they're such an integral part of who you are, not to mention all the experiences. And it's interesting that you mention, like, those examples of your dad. That is so often what people remember. It's not, oh, here are the top 10 philosophical points he made to me. It's, oh, he used to do this funny thing. And actually, you see a family grieving, and often that is the conversation of, oh, do you remember that he used to say this? Or he was forever forgetting to turn the kettle on and then getting angry at the kettle. Like, it's just random stuff that is of consequence because of your relationship to him.
Hugely. Because, you know, my dad did so many, like, amazing, incredible things that actually he had a really tragic life all the way through. But you're absolutely right that I will always remember that, like, he'd always really struggle to find his car keys, or he'd never take his shoes off when he'd come back from the garden, so my mom would go mental at him, and all those tiny little things. And I wonder if, like, Nobel laureates
still have that. You know, people that have won Grammys or perhaps like hosted the Oscars, if when eventually, unfortunately, they pass, their sort of loved ones are just thinking, oh, I remember how he never used to hang up his clothes or something like that.
I'd imagine so. But I like that in a way that it's very unifying. Like, I'd imagine even Barack Obama, his girls are still embarrassed by his dancing.
That's a really good example. And I think that's the thing of like actually being a dad. My dad was never my mate. We got on really, really well, but he was a perfect, perfect dad. And I think, again, it's kind of sad that you I was always sort of aware of that on some sort of level, but it's only afterwards that you think, you know what, like, he was good because he pushed me in the direction, but he didn't shove me. He gave me love, but he didn't wrap me up in cotton wool. And he was a brilliant, brilliant man. And I do think things are going to be so different after this. But I mean, you've got to try and blame the positive where you can. And I think one of the few positives, well, no, I think that's unfair. I think there are going to be many positives after lockdown. But I think one of them is definitely going to be that, like, the conversation around mental health isn't going to be people that are sitting on beanbags while wearing hemp yoga pants. They're actually going to be your builders. They're going to be your butchers. Like, it's mental that I heard that Piers Morgan was talking about mental well-being on Good Morning Britain. You're like, that is like the equivalent of Beelzebub talking about extolling the goodness of virtues. You know, it's so odd. And I think now people are going to realize that just like physical health, everybody has mental health, and it doesn't have to have been bad or have dipped for you to start looking after it.
Right. And I think that's part of how we've moved so far since wartime, you know, with that kind of rhetoric being very much around the pandemic as well. And at the time, there were conditions that just weren't at all understood. You know, PTSD was being called shell shock, and there were people that were killed for it by their own army. So in many ways, yes, there's still a way to go, but it's been transformational when you look at those kind of comparisons. And so I think this will be very uniting in many ways, that for the first time, many people, particularly those with certain conditions or just any mental health condition relating to anxiety, really, suddenly it's so understandable to people. Like, if you're feeling incredibly anxious and scared and you give the pandemic as the reason, suddenly everyone understands.
There's a huge empathy, and I'm not patriotic, but when I've seen in the papers about how perhaps other countries have negatively dealt with this, it does make me think, you know what, there are a lot of thoroughly good people that are around. That, yes, there's the clap for carers, but there's also the people that are going out and they're helping their neighbours. They're staying out of parks and shops and streets. They're going and seeing if they can donate money. I do think that sort of sense of unity, because nothing brings people together like a common enemy. And I think that's what this has done. This sort of virus has been a common enemy to actually unite people in a way that Brexit absolutely clawed people apart.
Yeah, previously to this, I was often talking about the Olympics as the last time the country really felt united. And whilst no one would say this is something we would want, whereas the Olympics is, there have been, quite rightly, as you say, positives that have and can continue to come out of it.
You almost have a duty in order to try and focus on those positives. Because I feel guilty about earlier on going, there's going to be a big bloody hangover after all of this. Because I think that, like, there's enough reason to despair. And actually, one of the things that has been great is that keeping calm and carrying on. And people haven't been scared to talk about their feelings, but they've also been very wary in order to try and put that best foot forward and then try and to bring everybody up together. And I think that has been amazing to see, this kind of balance between emotional honesty, but also this kind of positive attitude. I think that's been great.
Right, particularly in how you're processing all that's going on, with you being away from comedy, and that so often being a big part of how you process what you've been through with your mental health. How have you been finding not having that?
Not doing comedy is weird. There's a lot of emotions. Firstly, fear. I genuinely feel like I will never do comedy again. Like, it's, this is the longest that I've not done comedy in 10 years. And I'm like, oh my God. But then it's also been really great for writing. So I feel really conflicted because I've got more writing done now than ever before, but I've earned less money now than ever before. And getting back on that stage is going to be really surreal. So in terms of comedy in and of itself, I think it's got to evolve, and the jury's still out on how it's going to look. But my prediction for the future is the amount of shows that are going to be so much more personal, narrative driven shows rather than what's the deal with airplane food. It's going to be serious and soul searching things. And I think that's so exciting.
Definitely. And that's what I like in my comedy. I like politics. I like good mental health representation. I like feeling that I know the comic better at the end of it. A joke for everybody. I think maybe we've moved a bit beyond that at this point. And perhaps that's partly with how politically divided we can be, that people kind of want the reassurance of something that resonates with them.
I also think as well, so there is going to be a huge acceptance and appreciation of audiences after this. Normally it was always about what's the comic like, etc. But I think comics now are going to appreciate their fans, their audiences, and just anybody that supports live comedy so much more.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great place to finish up then. Thank you so much for joining me.
Brilliant.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.